For quite a few centuries, people have been wondering where mankind came from. And formally, this has been a question in the religious sphere for theologians to attempt to answer. And in the ancient Near East, at least, the answer to where man came from was very simple. Man was made by the gods. And the model that was proposed was what I call the appliance model. Gods got tired of doing their own work, so they invented home appliances, and they called them people. And they took care of the daily needs of feeding and clothing the gods and things like that. Now, that's not the picture that we see in the Bible at all. We don't see the gods needing mankind, or God needing mankind in the Old Testament. But with the rise of science, especially paleoarchaeology and biochemistry and so on, now with science, feels that it can make a contribution to the question of where we came from. Again, Gary Larson, one of my favorites, speculates that people closer to the time of human origins had a good feel for, you know, how the family trees work and this information is lost and now being recovered again, starting with the, amoeba, the dinosaurs, to, man that way. But again, today it's very much a battle, if you will, between the religious presentations and the scientific presentations regarding the origin of man. And what I would like, the question I'd like to look at this morning is basically, do the data clash between the scientific side and the scriptural side? And the reason I've entitled the talk A Survey of Enigmas is basically because I'm not going to end up with a clean, clear-cut answer by the time we're done. I think we're going to have, there's many, many questions in this area that need to be clarified before we can really say anything more definitely. Give you a feel for what I'm going to do. I'm going to give a presentation of the evidence as if we were at a talk given by Johansson or Leakey, one of the men, at least with respect to this fossil stuff, who is an active secular archaeologist. The reason I like to take that approach is because in many Christian circles, I think we've laughed at the Piltdown Man, we've laughed at Nebraska Man, the various hoaxes and very superficial data that goes back to the 1800s. But in the past 20 years or so, there's been quite an incredible explosion of fossil evidence regarding early man that we need to consider very seriously in trying to weigh scientific and scriptural data. The only difference I'll really take from their approach is to start from modern man and work backwards. They usually start with the earliest evidence and work forward. So the first type I want to look at is, again, modern man, which is usually referred to as anatomically modern human, Homo sapiens sapiens. To find evidence for modern man on a global extent, but in Europe, where he's been fairly well studied, goes back to about 35,000, 40,000 years before present. It's been referred to as Cro-Magnon man. It's from the sites where some of the fossils were found. General term against anatomically modern human. The earliest evidence that we have from fossils, from skulls and so on, is back to about 100,000 years before present. In Kufsa, which is a cave in Israel, we found a very nice Homo sapiens skeleton. And in South Africa also, there have been some finds, again, that are believed to be about this date back. Some feel that you can find traces of Homo sapiens sapiens back to around 300,000 BC. But again, the best clear stuff that we have is actually about 100,000. A few descriptors. The average brain size of anatomically modern human is around 1,350 cubic centimeters. That's just a reference point. Again, he had global distribution. It's not a continent that he's not found on, except for perhaps Antarctica at a very early date. Back at least to 35,000 before present, I don't think we have too much trouble saying that this fellow is us, or something pretty close to us, because he's associated with what I call pretty nice culture. Carving, painting, jewelry, flutes, and this kind of a thing. If you get National Geographic, you may remember this October 88 issue on the people under the earth, which is a discussion of the anatomically modern human and its distribution. This is approximately 20,000-30,000 years old carved ivory, and there's other things that they occasionally find in Europe and Central Asia like this. Again, definitely skilled artwork here in carving things. We're familiar with the cave paintings in France. Basically, yes, they certainly didn't have indoor plumbing and things like that, but had a reasonable amount of skill. There's a decent culture associated with the later types of anatomically modern humans. These are as far back as about 40,000 BC. Back to, once we get from 40,000 back to 100,000, we find anatomically modern human associated with what they would call Stone Age material, which is basically only fire and very well-made stone weapons. So at about 40,000 for anatomically modern human, there's a break in culture associated with the pond, and we get what I would call fairly decent culture at that time. Another point I should just mention, there's no surefire way to distinguish races from the skeletal anatomy that we have. In fact, the best skeletons that you find on display come from India, because it's generally considered that the Indian skulls are something nice in terms of shape. But again, anatomically modern human is a very uniform type of fellow out there. We step back beyond roughly about 40,000 BC, we run into the Neanderthal man. This is the fellow that's pretty commonly portrayed as the real robust caveman, stoop-shouldered, all that sort of thing. I'm not exactly sure that that description fits. However, from the skull, we can deduce that there's quite a more massive jaw than what anatomically modern human has. And most of the other features associated with the skull, the brow ridge, and so on, are basically there to support the stronger muscles associated with the jaw. And that's, you know, generally taken to be a more primitive feature. So again, there's a reasonable difference between the Neanderthal and anatomically modern human. He's found in Asia back to about 50,000 before present. In Europe, till about 30,000 before present, where he seems to be replaced by anatomically modern human. More on that later. Again, he's associated with a very robust features. That's the term that's used for massive jaw. Very heavy bone, make an excellent fullback on a football team. What's interesting with the Neanderthal is that their brain size tends to be larger than anatomically modern humans, 1300 to 1600 cubic centimeters. There's a lot of debate about the other features of the Neanderthal. Some Israeli scholars have felt that the pelvis structure is different enough that it would imply that they didn't quite fully walk the way anatomically modern humans does. So I haven't seen that picked up by other people in the literature, so that I'm a little nervous about. But there is reasonable debate about what exactly could Neanderthal do and not do in comparison to modern man. Some speculation also about whether they, the culture with Neanderthal, whether they really buried the dead. They definitely had fire, used fire, and are associated with the same level of stone tools that we see in anatomically modern human until about 40,000 BC. Then if you shift over to the fancy culture, you lose Neanderthal. But again, Neanderthal is associated with fire and halfway decent stone tools up to a point. And again, I should mention, we do have pretty clear evidence that injured and infirm Neanderthals did take care of each other. So there is a family or a social structure there in the Neanderthals, because we have Neanderthals that had lost an arm or definitely were crippled in some way and yet from their age or from healing at the wound, we can tell that they lived for some time, which must have been taken care of. This is just an arrangement of some of the fossils that we have, anatomically modern human, Neanderthal. And then there's a bird out there that they just sort of refer to as Homo sapiens archaic, or archaic Homo sapiens. There's a class of fossils out there that they really don't have a good feel for how to fit them in to the Neanderthal line, possibly into the anatomically modern human line, that really in a professional discussion, that's about all they say about it. And then there's these archaic things out there that they don't quite know how to fit in. So just to be complete, I think we should be aware that there are some things out there that look like hybrids or some blending between some of the types of fellows that we find out there. That's my general term for this. Okay, Homo erectus then is the next further back early man type that is found. He has a global distribution as well. He's found in Asia and Africa. Can't remember off the top of my head if he gets into Australia, but definitely far more than just in Africa. He's associated with fire and hunting, a more primitive type of tool, but nevertheless definitely recognizable as a made tool. Some wood tools he's also associated with as well. Differs from Neanderthal by the fact that he has a smaller brain size than what we find in Neanderthal. Somewhat more primitive teeth, again though, large jaw, and the associated brow ridge and such that are necessary to support the muscles that are driving the jaw. The skeleton of Homo erectus is pretty close to being that of modern humans. There's a very slight difference in the rib cage. The spinal column is smaller because the brain size is smaller, so you have a smaller hole in the vertebrae for the spinal cord, at least in the early Homo erectus. But again, fully bipedal and using tools and that kind of thing going on. Some people would feel that Homo erectus, there's some development there, and you can trace Homo erectus developing through some of these archaic lines into Neanderthal. That would be one of the schemes people would have for linking the two. To go back further, I forgot to mention the date there, just for the purpose of the tape. Homo erectus can be found from about 300 BC back to about 1.5 million years before present in Africa. Then he radiates into Asia at about 1 million before present. Homo habilis is the next early man that we find back there. Skull 1470 is probably one of the best representatives of that. This was discovered by Richard Leakey in 1972. So again, this stuff is going to be fairly recent here. He's found only in Africa. There's some argument that perhaps just a couple skulls from Java that are Homo habilis, but it's pretty well debated. Homo habilis is associated with some stone tools, considerably more primitive than what we find with Homo erectus, however. But most people feel that there's some use of taking a rock, chipping a couple of pieces off of it to make somewhat of a sharp edge to use with a scraper, that kind of thing. Nothing like the multifaceted stuff that we see later, though. Very clearly, though, Homo habilis was bipedal. That means he walked around very comfortably on his back 2 feet, on left the 2 forearms free to do whatever he wanted to do. Brain size is considerably smaller, even than Homo erectus, being down to about 670 cubic centimeters. He's around 4 to 4.5 feet tall and rather thin bone. That's of interest for trying to figure out how Homo lines relate to some of the other fossils that we find back there. Again, a very thin bone fellow. And he can be dated from about 2 million years back. This is associated with Homo habilis. fairly good evidence that it had a foot that could, that would work for bipedal motion very easily. Just to give you another side picture of skulls that are found here, the bottom one is Homo erectus. This, again, somewhat smaller brain cage. Not going to discuss very heavily the Australopithecine line. My general model is that those kind of went off into gorillas or just died out. Again, a much smaller brain case, a much more massive jaw than what we find in the Homo line of early man would be the term that they would use. The earliest fellow that's found out there is, was discovered by Don Johansson in 1974. He refers to her as Lucy. It's Australopithecine afarensis. This was nice in the fact that he found nearly a complete, well, not nearly a complete, but let's say about a 50% complete skeleton of Lucy. So we really get some detailed features of the anatomy, pelvis, they can deduce how it walked, finger bones, and that sort of thing. So we get a feel for how she was able to use her hands. This is a conglomeration from several afarensis skeletons of hand bones. So then you can see that we're not just working from a single tooth and drawing a picture of what the animal looked like at this level. We're working with half of a skeleton. And again, this is quite a bit of detail to be able to use in reconstructing how these things lived and what they did. Lucy was about 3 to 5 feet tall, depending upon whether it's male or female. There's some bimorphism between the sexes in these animals at this point. Very thick bone, however, again, quite a heavy thing. Much longer arms than what would be typical in a human, and short legs. So she's basically structured like a chimpanzee. The hands, I've read debated things. Some people feel the hands are quite human. Others say that there's some curvature in the finger bones that would imply that she still could get around in trees pretty well. Very small brain, as far as we can tell, about 400 cc for brain volume, which is around the size of a chimpanzee again. But unusual from the fact that she really seems to be fully bipedal, unlike most chimpanzees. The reason people deduce this is from a set of footprints that were found at Laetoli by Leakey, Mary Leakey, that date back to 3.7 million years. This is probably one of those strangest finds you'll ever get in the fossil record. What this is this was an ash layer from a nearby volcano. It just kind of burped. It gave off a layer, a couple inches of ash. And then it rained, turned the ash into about the consistency of concrete. And all kinds of animals wandered across it. There's, you know, giraffe that walks through here, a couple other things like that. But Lucy, who was the major hominoid alive at the time, also takes a skull as a kid. There's a kid walking beside an adult here. Apparently, further on, there's another adult track that goes across it. Continues for quite a ways. And then after this happened and the sun baked and dried it, then the volcano burped again before it could rain. Burped again and sealed it, and it has stayed that way and turned into rock, very delicate rock, for 3.7 million years. So you have a volcanic ash layer you can date very precisely, and a nice set of footprints that come out of it as well. That kind of blew people away, that there were things out there that were fairly bipedal at the time. This is one of the footprints from Laetoli, and this is Martin's footprint. The only real difference is, as you can see, that the toe kind of comes off to the side slightly, and the weight is not being fully put on the toes as it is in the modern human footprint. Nevertheless, the thing is quite clearly walking on its tubular legs through this volcanic ash. Again, this is felt to be Lucy's footprint in that regard. So again, we have a fellow out there that's very similar to a chimp. The teeth are considerably more human, though, than what chimps have today. And it could walk. No tools associated with it, however. But nevertheless, we have these fully bipedal hominoids walking around And again, the date for Lucy is pretty much between 3 to 4 million years before present. I mentioned Australopithecine series for a whole other line of hominoids that's found out there. And today there's a little debate for how to handle them, but basically the structure of the Australopithecine line is to have a very small brain, very massive jaw, but other than that, to be roughly human in anatomy. That means they were fully bipedal and had hands that were, you know, fairly good in terms of what they could grasp, opposable thumbs and that sort of thing. This is modern gorilla. This is Australopithecine africanus, which is a fairly lightweight Australopithecine series. Again, you can see very massive jaws on these guys, and the associated structure in the rest of the skull to support the muscles needed to drive the jaw. The pelvis on the Australopithecine is fairly close to being human. This is why they say they were bipedal, walked on their hind legs. This is chimpanzee here, and you can see that from the location of the, what I just call, well, not a great anatomy at this point, the plates on the pelvis, these are more associated for an animal that's stooped over and walking using its two front arms. But on the Australopithecine and modern man, you see that the plates are rotated sideways, which gives the femur, the upper leg bone, better support for being able to balance itself and greater ease of balancing itself upright just on the two of their legs. So we have Australopithecine, again, that's fully bipedal. Another feature in the Australopithecine line, again, is the teeth. This is modern gorilla, this is Australopithecine, and this is modern man. So again, we have these fellows out there running around on two rear legs, very human in some aspects, but again, with massive jaws, and we don't really know what happened to them in that regard. Okay. To try to sum it all together, I give you Johansson's chart. I think I have reproduced there. How Johansson strings them together is he starts off with his Lucy as the earliest really clear hominoid in the family tree. Again, from 4 to 3 million before present. Some gap here before we pick up the Australopithecine africanus, the very lightweight Australopithecine series, which then apparently develops into a later, robust, more massive Australopithecine, but then seems to die out. Johansson does not give any great hints or speculate in terms of what happens to this line, except that it goes extinct. Some people would argue that this becomes a gorilla line later on. I'll come back to that also. Johansson then sees his Lucy as a predecessor to Homo habilis over here, who starts the Homo line of the animal set. And he then goes on, again, some possible gap there to the Homo erectus, which then blends into Homo sapiens, which gives us modern man. Then you have some tools associated with these animals at this point. This is Johansson's model. One thing that happened here in, since Johansson developed this in Lucy's, at the time that he wrote the book Lucy, is they have discovered better Homo habilis evidence than what he had at the time. He himself dug up what he calls Olivi hominoid 52, early 52, in 1987. The problem with this Homo habilis skeleton that he found is that the arm bones are way too long. They're far more like a chimpanzee. The forearm bones are too long for him to comfortably merge that into Homo erectus. Independently of Johansson, another group found another Homo habilis skeleton that has the same problem. Again, the forearm is way too long to merge into Homo erectus later on. So what people are tending to do is to draw back Homo habilis into the Australopithecine line and say that we really don't have anything clear before Homo erectus in the human line, and that the Homo habilis is actually could be placed over here as perhaps a variety of Australopithecine africanus. It's also been found with some very primitive tool-use mathematical habilis with the Australopithecine line. So that becomes a very reasonable thing to do, is again to pull habilis over into the Australopithecine line. Then leaving you with kind of a, what do you do before Homo erectus gap? And then there's no real clear fossil evidence for what to do at that point. What do we find before Lucy? Just to carry things back a little bit. If we go back to about 10 million years, we can find some skeletons or fossils that refer to Ramapithecus, Ramapithecus, if you think right. But although that was maybe 10, 15 years ago, felt to be in the Homo line, from better evidence that we've gotten lately, it seems to be a branch going off to orangutan, rather than something that developed in the chimpanzee or ape or something like that. Again, once we start getting that far back, we only get very, very minimal fragments. There's an earlier fossil that's called Proconsul, and this is one of the best finds for that. Probably felt to be the first primate, first real monkey that's found 15, 20 million years back. Again, nothing very clear before Lucy that we could say is in a clear line to mankind, other than in a general way. A couple things I should just mention here before I move on from the fossil evidence to other things is, why is all this work being done in Africa? Why are all these early things being found there? For one thing, at least the sites in Kenya that the Leakeys are working, it's quite an ideal geography and climate for preservation of fossils and also for dating the fossils. This is the Olduvai Gorge, which, you know, everything seems to come from Olduvai that they find. It's not particularly true, but a lot comes from there. This area was a very lush meadowland, some forest nearby several million years ago. It was near a lake. It was also near a volcano that was active. So you have animals come in to the water, living by the water, whatever. Hominoids coming by for a drink, things dying and fighting and so on, or living by the water. And then a volcano would come along and leave some nice layers of ash behind that allow you to date everything quite easily. Then since then, you've had some streams and riverbeds that have come through that have cut these layers of sediments and ash and so on, so you don't really have to do much digging to go back a couple million years. You can just wander through the canyon looking up the side walls for curious things sticking out the wall to see, or stuff that has washed down into the bottom of the valley and then go up the wall looking for better finds in relationship to it. The dating that they can use then in this area is quite good because, again, it can be linked to volcanic action. Volcanic action can be pretty well dated with potassium argon methods. Johansson has a good chapter in his book, Lucy, on the exact details of how the method works that I found quite helpful. You can really date things in the canyon Olduvai region by three methods. Lava flows, by magnetic field reversals that you can trace in the lava and ash and so on, and also by other animals that were alive and are fossilized in with the human records at the same time. So you've got several tracks of evidence that you can use to date things in this region, which gives you pretty tight dates into what's going on there. Okay, the next line of evidence for origin man, or as scientific evidence goes, comes from chemistry, comes from the area of genetics. To give you our picture again, this is a typical animal cell. I remarked before about a complex in New York City, a simple cell, but it can replicate every 30 minutes. It's really pushed to do that. Then an incredibly complex organism here. And it has two major spotlight information for its ability to reproduce itself without a shortage of the nucleus in the DNA. It's becoming a fairly familiar term for conference. In human beings, there's 23 chromosomes, which can be isolated, then can be magnified, electron microscopy, to show you the stranding. There's still proteins associated with it at this point. The stranding, if you look at an individual strand, we can get some cell-to-cell, some curling in the DNA molecule at this point. And finally, blow it up to the point where we get to the actual sequence of the nucleic acids in the DNA chain, and that sequence is like the voice information that's recorded on a tape. And that can be read and analyzed to try to figure out the relatedness of the tape in monkeys, chimpanzees, or any other kind of life with the tape that's found in human cells. And when that study is made, we find a very high percentage of similarity in the DNA between primates and man. In fact, it's only at the level of 1 to 2% difference. And in terms of my talk of micro versus macro evolution the other day, really, I think I'd have to be pressed to say that this is at a level where it could be considered to be microevolution if you wanted to work it that way. There's no new organs being developed or something. It's a very low percentage difference. The similarity, if analyzed, can give you a feel for how distinct the animals are. And then if we work with a rate of change, how often does a mutation occur in the DNA, and add those changes up over time, and try to relate a change that we see in some animals but not in others, we will then be able to construct trees, as we see here, of, you know, human and ape have a common difference at one spot in their DNA that's not seen in orangutan and gibbon. And by analyzing these kinds of differences, we're able to come up with the relatedness of animals to each other and to get some feel for what's considered to be the time difference, the time back to the last common ancestor for the various primate lines. This is a result here where we have the chimpanzees, some speciation among the chimpanzees. It's very late, but the last common chimpanzee human ancestor is about 6 million years back, figured by this method. The gorilla, last common ancestor between gorilla and the human chimpanzee line, is about 10 million years back, and so on, back to orangutan and some of the other primates in the series. Again, given the very small percentage differences between the DNA, it's hard to jump in and attack this method. There's another series of DNA that's found, and that's found in the mitochondrion. These are the little energy factories in the cell. And they have some DNA in them, which is responsible for making some proteins that are uniquely found inside the little energy factory here of the mitochondria. What's interesting with mitochondria and why they're studied, why this DNA is studied, is because the mitochondria are only passed along from the mother in the offspring. What happens is, again, the egg cell contributes the guts of the cell, but the DNA comes from, half of it comes from the sperm, half of it comes from the mother. But the DNA in the mitochondrion, because that's in the cytoplasm of the cell, only comes from the mother's lawn. So if you look at the DNA here, you're not seeing any genetic mixing at all. You're following that DNA back to, the only thing that changes this DNA is an actual mutation in the information there. And that you can trace back and analyze the percentage differences between the various mitochondrial DNAs that are found in different populations of people around the world, and try to deduce how related are the various people that we find. This doesn't work between species all that well, but within one species of animal, it works fairly well. So again, we're only looking at what would be called the mother's DNA, you know, your grandmother's mitochondrial DNA being passed through you. If we analyze the differences in the mitochondrial DNA, we get an incredibly small divergence among all populations of humans on the Earth, from Aborigines to pygmies to Madison Avenue. You find about a 0.3% divergence in this mitochondrial DNA between all modern humans. That blew people's socks off, because that's incredibly smaller than what people were expecting to find. The next smallest difference that was found out there was within one subspecies of Africa, living in one geographic area, where the difference was twice that of what's found in modern humans that has a global distribution. And the largest distribution in the mitochondrial DNA within a group was found in about a 5% difference in orangutan, again in a subspecies of orangutan. So there's something going on here with modern humans where there's a very, very low divergence in the mitochondrial DNA, which implies a very high relatedness among all the modern humans that are found. Let me jump down here to the picture to illustrate that. Because what that implies, the very, very small divergence in mitochondrial DNA, allows you to distinguish between two models of human origins that have been being picked around. The first model was the global radiation model, which starts with the idea of a very early radiation, again, the Homo erectus, about 1 million years ago, from Africa throughout the rest of the continents in the world. And then there was Homo erectus in Europe, Homo erectus in Africa, China, and Java. And these Homo erectus independently evolved through Neanderthal up into anatomically modern humans in their individual areas, okay, with some trading and intermixing going on, but pretty much it was a independent evolution up to Homo sapiens in these areas with some mixing going on. If this model were true, we'd expect to see a much larger divergence in the mitochondrial DNA than what they actually find, because again, mankind has been pretty much independent for about 1 million years in this model. The mitochondrial DNA implies is that radiation of modern human to a global extent happened far later than the Homo erectus distribution. So yeah, there's Homo erectus out there who went around globally and perhaps developed into Neanderthal and a couple of other things, but somebody over here on the side chain became anatomically modern human about 150,000, 200,000 years ago, and that dude came out of Africa, knocked off everybody else, and is replaced, you know, the hominoid is anatomically modern human. Now the guys who hold this model are, you know, kind of upset with the data, and these guys are cheering the data, so there's this real tension in the literature at the moment between the two models, because the mitochondrial DNA again points to a very recent global distribution of mankind, again at the expense of apparently the other hominoids that were running around. Now, some dates have been given for the what's called the mitochondrial Eve. That refers back to, again, the mother whose mitochondria contributed the DNA that is now seen in all anatomically modern humans. Let me knock this compass over here. I should point out that that could be a statistical fluke, or it could be only the result of a small population. What happens here in the statistics is the same thing that happens in family names. If a father does not have any male children, only girls, then his last name dies out in the next generation. It wouldn't be carried on. Well, the same thing happens if the mother has only boys, because then her mitochondrial DNA is not carried on to any girls and pass it on to their children. So over the course of time, you would expect to see only one mother in effect back there. The problem is that that mother seems to be very busy. And again, that could be a statistical fluke. It could be the result of not just a single original Adam and Eve couple. It could be a small population that speciated into modern anatomically and modern humans. But of that small population, only one of the mothers' mitochondrial DNA seemed to pass on. So again, it's not clear evidence of Adam and Eve and that sort of a thing. But it does show, and people are willing to say, that there was at least a pinch in the human population very recently, but then globally distributed again at the expense of apparently other animals. Let's take a look at a third line of evidence for human. And this comes to us from anthropology. The basic argument here is, this is something that we need to think about, is what is it that makes us human? Is it television? Is it microwave oven? The subway? As Sidney Harris points out here, the supporting genes and evidence of fact lead to the conclusion that the caveman used this tunnel for the express line of the subway system. You know, is that how we're going to determine what it is that makes us human? Is it automobiles that allow us to conclude that, you know, here's anatomically modern human and poor Neanderthals back to the stone wheels. So, you know, that's why he outcompeted Neanderthal. But again, what is it that makes us human? Anthropologists have really been trying to debate this for some time. If we look in and say it has something to do with the culture that we can find associated with human remains, then again, that becomes a good question to try to determine what it is. Do we call it science, in which case there were no modern humans until, you know, 1,000 AD or so? Do we refer to metal as what it is that's a human feature? Do we apply it to writing, which basically say weren't any humans before about 3,000 BC? Do we say agriculture and cities are what allow us to say, okay, these guys are definitely human? Cities first show up about 8 to 10,000 BC. Jericho is a good example of one of the first cities in that regard, as far as we know. We refer to the domestication of animals, which occurs 15, 20,000 years back with dogs, sheep, goats, that kind of thing. Also, agricultural, by the way, is the domestication of barley and wheat and several grains to from wild grains to, you know, lemon grow. Be easier to handle. Do we say it's the use of stone tools and fire? Or do we say it's the fact that we see something that's a hunter and a gatherer in terms of its culture? Again, the criteria here that we use become rather tricky, because if we look back at Johansson's chart here, we have this problem. We say that it's hunter-gatherer, that could apply to anything in the Australopithecine line. If we say some stone tools are allowed, then again, Homo habilis or pulling it over into the Australopithecine line, that seems to exist. Then if we refer to fire, a fairly good tools in fire, that's clearly in the Homo erectus line, if we go back a million and a half years. If we refer to bipedal anatomy and the opposable thumb, well, that can be applied to anything on this chain. That all works everywhere. There's a couple of features that people have pulled out that they like to refer to. One of them is speech. This is one that I kind of like too. When did these hominoids develop the ability to talk at a fairly sophisticated level? I'm sure not everything could speech, but when should you get to be talking? In that and cultural change, and that the Homo erectus are using the same tool set at 1.5 million years as they are at 500,000 years. For a million years, the toolbox stays the same. So there's no innovation, there's no real creativity scene going on here. There's just, okay, we know how to make these things, and we'll bang them out and use them for hunting. And some people felt, okay, look, you really can't call it human until you see cultural change taking place. And again, that puts things very late. to start doing that. These are all secular guys, by the way. I mean, these aren't Christians trying to date Adam later or anything like that. But one of the features in this that we need to recognize in these criteria is that there's none that are truly unique to man, except in their degree. Okay? That you know, everything can talk to some level, porpoises can talk to some level. There's, you know, what level do we want to say that society became advanced or modern human? You know, baboons have some culture, some society, and that they live in groups and things. So again, when anthropologists have looked out there for what is the uniquely human element, they've had difficulty trying to do something again because they find various degrees of what men have considered human in hominoids, early hominoids, and in some other animal. So, that's the overview then of where we're at. And what I'd like to do now is try to summarize two sets of problems. One, the problems in science that I see there, and the other, the problems from the biblical standpoint. For science, there's several problems in dealing with the fossil evidence. One of them is, where are the gorillas located? Johansson feels that because gorillas lived in a forest environment, they weren't well fossilized, and therefore we have no evidence in terms of how primates evolved into gorillas. Griffin Charafis has written a book, The Monkey Puzzle, in which they speculate that some of these Australopithecine series that we see just seem to disappear actually moved back into the forest off the savannas and became the gorillas and chimps, and again, Ramapithecus into orangutan. We can account for primates in that way. But again, where did the other primates come from is a debated issue that's out there. The other problem with the evidence is, where's the continuity? I already mentioned Olivine-Holmgren 62, which Johansson discovered himself brought the tabulus line over into the Australopithecine line because her arm bones are way too long to really expect it to be the predecessor of Homo erectus. Again, that seems to be being confirmed. So again, we have this gap from Australopithecine over to Homo that does not have any clear evidence for how we went from one to the other. There's also a question at the Neanderthal level here before we get over into modern man. What happened to Neanderthal, and how does Neanderthal, which seems to have developed from Homo erectus, relate to anatomically modern human? In other words, there should be a Neanderthal branch up here and question mark relating it over into human, because that is a very hotly debated area in terms of what happened with the Neanderthal race or species, depending upon how you want to figure it out. So again, what we're working with here is very slim fossil evidence. And what I find encouraging in the field today is that the guys who are working on it are quite willing to admit that it's sketchy and they might not ever be able to really solve it. David Philby and Richard Leakey here is quoting him, says it's my conviction there may be many aspects of human evolution that will always elude us. We need to be straightforward and honest about that. So again, the guys that are working on this material realize that it's sketchy and that you might not ever really be able to come down with some conclusive evidence that links all these early hominoids together. From the biblical standpoint, though, we've got a different series of questions to weigh. The first of these, of course, is where was Adam in this line of hominoid development? We could put him at many points, I think. Some, I suppose, could put him all the way back with Lucy. Some could say, no, he doesn't really show up until we see that culture 40,000 years before present. Very definitely anatomically modern human. Some could put him back at 150, 200,000 years and say, okay, he was with mitochondrial Eve at that pinch, or some could say, no, he goes back to Homo erectus, and when we first see that line develop. There's several plausible points, I think, where you could say, okay, God did something here to give us a special human race. So the question becomes then, I think, now remember though, that all these things are related, I have my little note here, all these things are related at the microevolutionary level. So what we have to say is, in a sense, back off and say, was there a special creation of the human race? This is where there's a big difference between theistic evolutionists and special creationists. I put myself in the camp of special creationists. Theistic evolutionists would say that the apes developed and God came along and put a soul in one of them and that became Adam and Eve. I would say the special creationists would say, okay, there's some parallel lines, there's some common design, but the account we find in Genesis 2 that God made Adam special reflects what actually happened. That God made Adam and Eve special, and from them we have the fall and the development of, you know, the race of anatomically modern human as we see them today. Now, I do admit, though, that that becomes, to say that there was an Adam and Eve and a special creation becomes a historical problem, one that we cannot deduce from the fossil evidence or the genetic evidence that we have today. And I propose that that's similar. Here we have a case where the biblical data is telling us something that the natural data doesn't tell us. But this we see in many, many other fields. We see this in relation to the Ten Commandments. The Bible tells us that God gave them specially to Moses on Mount Sinai. And yet, a liberal naturalistic explanation would say that somebody deduced them from parallel law codes from other cultures. And yet there's enough differences there between the Mosaic laws and their emphases, the laws from other cultures, to say, no, I think that yes, you could argue this, but the better explanation is that they do have a supernatural origin. Again, with humans, I think we have the same historical problem here. That again, there's similarity between animals and man, but we can't deduce from that that God just grabbed an animal and made him into a man, if he's taken the time to tell us that he made man special. So, then do the data clash? I could argue in summary, as John Studenroth was mentioning last night, that similar design does not necessarily prove descent. You look at automobiles and the common starter that shows up in five different lines at the same time, but does not necessarily prove descent. And a row of fossils does not necessarily prove a genealogy. The fact that you can logically order them does not necessarily mean that one was the ancestor and the other one was the descendant from the other. Similarly, anatomy and DNA show either descent or that God has copied a primate pattern in human beings. Now, the question comes around from the other side is, why would God do that? I mean, why would God take same hemoglobin, same cytochrome C, same basic primate skeletal structure, and so on and so forth, and say, we're going to make that into a being in our own image? Why would he do that? First of all, I had a couple sleepless nights thinking this one through. It was like, wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't it be great if when we did the genetic code studies on human beings, we discovered that all the other life forms code their proteins in the DNA in an entirely different way than human beings do? Wouldn't that take every atheist and lay him on the altar saying there's got to be a God out there? Wouldn't that be incredible to find a difference in the microbiology of the animal at that point? It'd be just so incredibly unique. Well, then I thought what Carl Sagan would do is something like that. What he would do on the cosmos theories is he'd point that fact out and he'd look up and say, that means we came from space. And that would be that, you know, and everyone would laugh, ha ha, isn't that great? And, you know, there must have been a second influx from space of the precursors to mankind. Oh, wow, you know, and everyone would think it was great. So again, the fact that there's not a great distinction or that there would be a great distinction, men would still find a rationalization to get around it, to conclude that they got here by chance or from some intelligence other than the God of the Bible. So why do we have a similarity then? One reason, I think, is that The general bipedal anatomy in animals seems to be one of the most flexible designs out there for being able to function, get around, and take care of oneself. But I think from more perhaps the philosophical side, the similarity has some other purposes. One of them is to keep us humble. You know, God told Adam that he was dust. And man has had a tough time believing that. Until Copernicus came along, he felt that he was the center of the universe. You know, the earth went around the sun, the earth was the center of the universe, and all the beings that were out there really got their jollies out of watching mankind run around at the center of the universe. Well, then Copernicus comes along and says, no, man is really just one of the planets in the solar system. Then they come along with telescopes and say, well, man is just on an average star in an average galaxy in an average universe. Really, there's no great cosmological significance to mankind's placement in the universe. So then man says, okay, well then I've got to be unique in some other way. You know, I've got this great brain, I've got fantastic abilities. And then we do the biochemistry and say, no, really, you're not all that much different than the animal life that's running around you. So again, God says we're dust. And really, when we look around at the cosmological and the biochemical level, God's finally proven to be right. We're not that unique. And what I really find out there is that our value as human beings is not biologically inherent, is not cosmologically inherent, but only is derived from the value that God gives us. Scriptures say that God made man in his own image, that he loves us, that he died for us. It's from God's perspective that mankind has a special value. And if men want to throw away the special revelation, then all that God's going to leave them with is the feeling that they're animals. In the universe, this is a dust. So I think we see here, you know, in a sense, God setting it up that way, so that in a fall, or in a whatever, that man would have no grounds for holding to a supremacy of himself. In that way. With that, I come to my last slide. I can close, take questions or whatever. Thank you.